We're going to continue with Goblin Market. And there's actually a ton of amazingly great poetry for this week, too. And we're not going to be able to do it all, but, you know, second papers, stuff like that. Here, I wanted to show you, just one sheet, are Dante Gabriel Rossetti's illustrations for the first edition of Goblin Market when it came out. So he did what's called the frontispiece, which is an illustration at the very beginning of a book, and then he also did an illustration on the title page. And as you'll see, Laura did these too, right? Did she show these illustrations? Did you do Goblin Market with Laura, or?
That was when I was still auditing the class, and only there half the time I missed Goblin Market.
Oh, okay.
No.
So I think, anyhow, so I think she did. But you weren't there. So, okay, so what you will see is that there are two illustrations. The first one is the one about the part we're going to get to soon today. We're going to try to finish the poem today. Don't laugh. You're laughing behind your mask. The second one is much later, but what Dante Gabriel Rossetti is seeing in his sister's poem, which is neat and interesting and lovely, is that the goblins are asking her to buy from us with a golden curl. So you can see the caption to the frontispiece on the left. And then on the right, when Lizzie and Laura are in bed together, the description of them is golden head by golden head. So those two moments, he's picking up on the word golden. You know, that's fine. They're blonde-haired. It's not oh, my God, what symbolism. But he is picking up on a kind of resonance in both the goblins being interested in her hair color and then the two sisters, when they're together, producing this kind of harmony in their hair color, golden head by golden head. What we're going to try to do, just to tell you, is finish Goblin Market today, and if there is some time left, we won't have time to do Matthew Arnold, who is often, people love Matthew Arnold but shouldn't. And he was a kind of oppressive critic, famous for saying that he basically is the most conservative kind of cultural figure within Victorianism. His idea of what poetry is, what literature is, that it is civilization versus anarchy, and that literature is the redoubt of civilization, is just the kind of thing that avoids seeing poetry at its deepest. So at any rate, he's a lot of people's favorite. He's my least favorite. And if we had time, of course we would do them, but we don't. One interesting factoid I'll just tell you is if you read the poems of James Henry, which you did for today, of course, it was Christopher Ricks, the editor of this volume, who essentially rediscovered James Henry, who now appears in Victorian anthologies. He was walking through the library one day and he saw this book, Poems of James Henry, from 1856 or whenever it came out. And he did a double take because he thought, wait, Henry James wrote poetry? I didn't know about that. So do people know who Henry James is? Maybe the greatest novelist in the English language. And anyhow, totally amazing. Lots of movies made of his books as well. Maybe most famous now for Turn of the Screw. But at any rate, Sir Christopher, since he was knighted a few years ago, saw this book in the library and thought, Henry James? No, wait, it's actually James Henry. How funny. But he pulled the book off the shelf and started reading the poems, and he thought, hey, these are actually really pretty good. So he put him in this anthology, and then other anthology makers, without acknowledging it, without acknowledging that Sir Christopher rediscovered James Henry, also put in James Henry into their anthologies after this anthology came out. And he's pretty good. there are a lot of people who are pretty good. But what we're going to try to do is, as I say, do... hi, Quincy. Try to do the finish Goblin Market, try to start the Rubaiyat of Omar Khayyam, which may have been the single most popular poem of the Victorian period, or poem sequence of the Victorian period. And I heard somewhere that it's the single most popular poem sequence in English, in the history of English poetry. It was a thing, it was a perennial bestseller for like almost a century. People really, really, really love it. And we're also going to try to look at George Meredith's Modern Love. Sir Christopher says in the introduction to this anthology that he... is really trying to give you full sequences. That is, as we saw with Amour de Voyage, that is that he tries to give you all the poems in if they make up a larger work. He doesn't do it with In Memoriam, and he doesn't do it with Modern Love, which is unfortunate, but you probably will think it's fortunate. When you do sit down in your later life to read all of them, you will probably say, lucky thing we didn't read all of this in the spring of 2023 in that course. So you may feel that way, you may not. But anyhow, Modern Love is a really fascinating sequence, and we will try to do that. I just wanted to show one other tiny thing in Coventry Patmore, and then we're not going to do any more. We won't do any Patmore of him. I'll just show you two things. Coventry Patmore is one of those poets who is much, much better than his reputation, as we saw, I hope, the first day of class when we did the poem Magna Est Veritas, the poem that ends, "The truth is great and shall prevail when none cares whether it prevail or not." That is, it's a strangely bitter poem. I think it's worth it looking for bitterness in Patmore, who believed himself to be a believer. So if you look at the poem just to the left of that, this is on page 324, the poem called The Toys. The first half of that poem is really moving, and it is just worth seeing, A, how moving it is, and B, what it is that he has to do to somehow escape from his own anguish. But just the first half, "My little son, who looked from thoughtful eyes and moved and spoke in quiet, grown-up wise, having my law the seventh time disobeyed, I struck him and dismissed with hard words and unkissed his mother, who was patient, being dead." So a little, slightly incoherent in a way that is worth noticing it, worth noticing. So "my little son" looks like the subject of the sentence, but isn't. It is a kind of adverbial phrase identifying who it is that the speaker interacted with. So "my little son, who looked from thoughtful eyes and moved and spoke in quiet, grown-up wise." So he's like a grown-up, even though he's a little boy. We're about to find out why. having my law the seventh time disobeyed. So not very grown-up-like of him, not very quiet of him, but somehow he's irritated his father. Having done that, I struck him. And dismissed with hard words and unkissed. You think he dismissed his son with hard words and unkissed. But it turns out the direct object of that is his mother, who was patient being dead. So just think of the psychological complexity of that. As I say, this is worth really thinking through in great detail. We just don't have time. But the person he dismisses unkissed and with hard words is the boy's mother. So you would think, okay, I get what's happening. It's a little bit hard, but I get what's happening. The father's being one of those fathers, those brutes. And the mother is intervening and saying, don't be so hard on him. But the father is dismissing her too. You're just spoiling him, Gertrude. Something like that. Except that he dismissed with hard words and unkissed his mother, who was patient, as a Victorian wife should be, being dead. Well, wait. So it turns out that the mother is dead, and he dismisses her despite the fact that she's dead. So how does that happen? Well, just quickly, how does that happen? He yells at his son. How does he feel? He beats his son. How does he feel? Is he just self-righteous about it at that point? So what happens, Leon?
He probably feels bad, right?
Uh-huh.
Yeah, by hitting his son, he felt like this is something his deceased wife wouldn't want to see.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So it's as though he beats his son and has a flash of what his wife, how his wife would have replied, would have responded to that. And he's angry. So he dismisses her in his mind. She flashes into his mind, his dead wife, and he dismisses her. What does that tell you about why he beats his son? Or maybe a preliminary question, what does that tell you about why his son moves and speaks in quiet, grown-up, wise, and has thoughtful eyes? Why is his little son like that? Thank you. Yeah. Yes. Trauma of parental loss. So here in the scene setting, we suddenly know a whole lot about the two of them. That the son is in mourning for his mother, and the mode of that mourning is to be grown up and quiet and thoughtful, and also to be at odds with his father over something. Having my law the seventh time disobeyed. And we know of the father that he is angry and takes it out on his son. Angry over what?
Probably losing his wife.
Yeah, the trauma of spousal loss. Yeah. So here you have a father and a son, and the mother is dead. And their actions and motives are actions and motives that are the results of that. So I dismissed his mother. She came into his mind, and I dismissed her. And she was patient, being dead. And then he feels guilty. Then, fearing lest his grief should hinder sleep, I visited his bed and found him slumbering deep with darkened eyelids. So he does fall asleep. So Coventry Patmore is afraid, no, his son is going to be lying awake after all of this. But no, I found him slumbering deep with darkened eyelids, and their lashes yet from his late sobbing wet. So he goes to bed, he sobs himself to sleep. Patmore sees that he's done that. And I, with moan, kissing away his tears, left others of my own. So he's weeping. So both of them are weeping, but they can't share it. Why does he weep? For on a table drawn beside his head, he had put within his reach a box of counters and a red-veined stone, a piece of glass abraded by the beach, and six or seven shells, a bottle with bluebells, and two French copper coins ranged there with careful art to comfort his sad heart. So it's just a beautiful vignette. He's then going to generalize from this about his own life. The second half of the poem is good too. A little bit hard to interpret, I think, because it's hard to know how much faith he actually has. Red.
Quick comment. Is that line, the two French copper coins, supposed to be an allusion to how they would put coins over the eyes of their dead to pay for passage into the afterlife?
I think it's on Patmore's mind. Yeah. I don't think it's on the child's mind, and I think that this is probably a true story, and there were those two French copper coins, but it's striking to him and striking in the poem for just the reason that you say, that it's paying Charon for passage. But it's this, he sees these objects of comfort, and, you know, they're just little things that the child can think about, focus on, think of as having some value, think of as having some meaning to him. Not a deep meaning, but the whole point is he doesn't want depth. He wants to get away from depth and just play with something trivial. And that causes Patmore to weep. That too causes him to weep. So those objects play a kind of either single or dual role, depending on how you think of it. A dual role, which is for the child, they're distracting. For him, they're the sign of how the child needs distraction. But a single role. They are both, in their grief, focusing on these little things, on these little objects, which you can focus on. So it's just wanted to point that out to you because I think it's immensely moving. Another completely different poem that I wanted to point out to you by Patmore, and that will be the end of Patmore, is the page before, the poem called The Kiss, which is funny, as is the poem right below it, Constancy Rewarded. So this poem is called The Kiss, and it's a little dialogue. "I saw you take his kiss," says one woman to her friend. "'Tis true," the friend says. "I did let him kiss me. So I saw you take his kiss. 'Tis true." "Oh, modesty." And then she says, "No, I was modest." "Like, how modest were you?" says the first woman. No, I was modest." "Modesty? 'Twas strictly kept." "How?" "He thought me asleep." So it was okay. I didn't kiss back. He thought I was asleep. He stole a kiss. Yes. We know, but this is just the little story here. "He thought me asleep. At least I knew he thought, I thought, he thought I slept." So even though it turns out that he knows that she was awake, she still maintains her modesty because she's saying that I can just repeat the line. He thought I slept. So can people follow that third order? It turns out psychologically that most human beings can follow five nestings. This is something that people who do cognitive literary studies get really interested in. Most people can do five nestings of she thought, he believed, they knew, the enemy miscalculated their plans to mess with them psychologically. So we can follow that. If you go one more level it's about 50-50 for who can follow it. If you go a level beyond that, you're getting to a couple of sigmas out for who can follow it. And one thing that people interested in cognitive literary studies of this sort are interested in is the way the author has to think about what the reader can understand about what a character who is estimating the beliefs of another character about the evaluations that another character is making, how much you can nest it. So whenever you have thinking about thinking or thinking about thinking about thinking and so on, the thing is, not the think, but the thing is, that the author is one level beyond the reader in doing that, because the author has to think about what the reader is thinking about, what the characters are thinking about, etc. So that a lot of kind of borderline difficulty or borderline authorial authority, you could say, is that the author can go yet one level deeper. We won't do it in this class, but there's a kind of interesting version of this, which anyone take econ? Okay, so do you know about the winner is a person who can think of a number who's closest to a number, which is, do you know who Colin Kammerer is? Is that a name?
No.
Okay.
I'm a very bad econ teacher.
Uh-huh. Okay. I think that she will get me to believe that she's a bad econ major. Okay, so here's a little party game you can do, and it's actually kind of interesting if you do it in an econ class versus if you do it in an English class. Everyone in the room should write down a number between 1 and 100. Don't do it. We're not going to do it. Everyone in the room should. No, we got too much to do. But if everyone in the room tries to write down a number which is 70% of the average of what everyone in the room writes down, a number between 1 and 100, whoever comes close to 70% of the average of what everyone writes down will win this $10 bill, which is, I'm not actually offering you a $10 bill because we're not actually doing this, but I actually have gone through a lot of $10 bills doing this in other classes. Especially classes that have to do with game theory and math. So think about it. So everyone writes down a number which is supposed to be 70% of the average of the numbers everyone else writes down. So think about it for a second. Don't change your number. And then we're just going to quickly go around the room. Sophia, what would you write down? Remember, it's between 1 and 100. You want to write down 70% of the average of everyone else's guesses, including yours, of everyone's guess, including yours. So what would you write down?
Like 45.
Okay, what would you write down?
99.
Really? So even if everyone wrote down 100.
Oh, no. Yeah. Probably like 40.
Okay, so 45, 40?
49.
49, okay.
Okay,
so look, we have 45, 40, 49.
Wait, are we saying the numbers we write down? Or
yeah, you want to write down a number which is 70. Everyone wants to write down a number which is 70% of the average of the numbers that everyone has written down. So here we have 45, 40, and 49. So it's roughly 45 is the average of the first three. So a good, so the winning number would be like 30 if they said 49. 40, 45, 40, 49, the right answer would be about 30, right? 70% of their average.
Okay.
Although your 30 is going to bring it down slightly, so maybe 28. Okay, does that make sense?
Not really, but sure.
Oh.
What did
you guys have?
35.
Okay.
27.
Okay.
37.
37. Okay. So if you do this with economists who played this game before, the right answer is 1. If you do it with completely naive people, the right answer is 35. because you say, okay, completely naive people who don't know what they're doing, the average number they're going to put down is going to be 50, like half of them will be above 50, half of them will be below, it's going to average at 50, so 35 would be the right answer. Okay, does that make sense, Marina?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
But then you do second order and you say, but wait, everyone in the class is going to realize the right answer should be 35, which means the right answer should be 70% of 35, which is about 24 and a half, right? But then you're going to say, no, third order, everyone in this class is going to realize the right answer is going to be 24 and a half. So I am going to do 70% of 24 and a half, which is, let's say, 16. But what's everyone going to realize if they're econ majors? If they're econ grad students, what are they all going to realize?
Never go into a fight with a Sicilian.
Yeah. Yeah, that's what they're going to realize. So what everyone is going to have to do is keep iterating this so they pick 70% of what everyone would have thought on the previous iteration. If one is the lowest number they can do, it's all going to converge onto one. So that is what happens when you think about what other people are going to think about, what other people are going to think about, what other people are going to think about, and so on. In fact, if you do it with, if we had more time and didn't have any confusion about this, it turns out if you do it with people who are not, who haven't had a class on this and don't know how to go through this, the correct answer is actually more like 15. And the reason is because after thinking about, okay, it's the average of the average they're going to put down when they think about putting down the average of what everyone puts down, but it's going to be 70% of that, but they're all going to do 70% of that. After four or five iterations, they stop doing that. They don't say, yes, it converges on one. They say, okay, it's the average of the average of the average of the average of the average, the end. And that turns out to be about 15. You know, if you need a way to make money, this is a way you can. And people who put down one lose because they have forgotten that people can't do too many iterations. Okay, I'm so glad that I did that quickly and clearly and with such lucidity. At any rate, the Coventry Patmore version of this is that he, the poet, is thinking that we, the reader, will focus on how the first woman understands how the second woman understands how the guy believes that she thinks that he imagines that she's asleep. So this is, so if you get the author and the reader into this nest here, Coventry Patmore is giving us a character, the first woman, who is hearing from the second woman how she knew that the guy thought that she believed that he thought that she was asleep. So he didn't think she was asleep, but he thought she was asleep. The second woman now has to take that in, and we have to take in the fact that the second woman is taking that in, and Coventry Patmore is taking account of all of that. Okay, so a nice little delightful poem that was not hard at all, I've now succeeded in making really, really hard.
Wow,
so
the English language is awful.
Is awful?
Yeah.
How come?
They say English speakers have it easy. I feel bad for the non-English speakers.
You mean trying to figure out a poem like this? Yeah,
yes.
But you could be reading this in Latin, and then you would feel bad about Latin.
I mean, I'm sure I've probably done something like this in Latin in my freshman year. I just don't remember because I wasn't the best Latin student.
Because too many nested attitudes, as they're called. Okay, I'm glad we went through that really fast. Now let's go back to Goblin Market.
Before that, I have a question.
Yes.
So, this picture,
Yes.
So, if Dante was aware that both of them are blonde,
uh-huh.
So why is, I assume this is Lizzie here at the corner of the other picture?
Uh-huh.
Why is she, no.
Oh, yeah, what, as she's going away.
Yeah.
Yeah, it... Yeah, I mean, I think that's the answer. But another answer might be, so do people see Leon's question? That on the top left is Lizzie going away, not being seduced by the goblin men. And her hair is dark. But then when you see them golden head by golden head, her hair is less dark. Can you tell which one is which in the golden head by golden head? Do you recognize which one is which from the illustration to the left?
Is she also the one on the left?
I think so. They are sisters, so they look very much alike, but I think so partly because it's almost the same point of view that you're getting. So that would then be Lizzie on the right, and does she look like the Lizzie in at the top left of the frontispiece? Not that much, but maybe enough. But I think the point about the frontispiece is we're only supposed to see one of them as having having golden curls, and so he cheats a little bit, as people do, which is, okay, she's got hair, and maybe she has a shawl. I should look at a bigger version of it. But we're only supposed to notice the golden hair of one of them in the left-hand illustration, but notice the golden head by golden head in both of them in the right-hand illustration. So I don't have a better answer than that.
Well, that makes sense.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah, the wind in the willows goblins.
Yeah.
Okay. So she turns home alone. Let's pick up then at 287. She goes home with the one kernel stone and knew not was it night or day. After sucking all the fruit globes of the goblins, having paid for them with a golden curl. So, you know, this is like inviting a vampire over the threshold. You shouldn't do that. Don't give anything with your DNA in it to goblins. There, at least, is a moral to the story. So Lizzie met her at the gate. She goes home. And I guess let's go counterclockwise today. Clockwise today. So Julia, can you read the next stanza? Lizzie met her at the gate. Page 287. That's okay.
So starting that, Lizzie met her at the gate?
Yeah.
Okay. Lizzie met her at the gate, full of wise upbraidings. Dear, you should not stay so late. Twilight is not good for maidens. Should not loiter in the glen in the haunts of goblin men. Do you not remember Jeannie, how she met them in the moonlight? Took their gifts, both choice and many, ate their fruits and wore their flowers, plucked from bowers where summer ripens at all hours. But ever in the noonlight, she pined and pined away, sought them by night and day, found them no more, but dwindled and grew gray, then fell with the first snow, while to this day no grass will grow where she lies low. I planted daisies there a year ago that never blow. You should not loiter so. Nay, hush, said Laura. Nay, hush, my sister. I ate and ate my fill, yet my mouth waters still. Tomorrow night I will buy more, and kissed her. Have done with sorrow. I'll bring you plums tomorrow. Fresh on their mother twigs, cherries worth getting. You cannot think what figs my teeth have met in, what melons icy cold, piled on a dish of gold, too huge for me to hold, what peaches with a velvet nap, pellucid grapes without one seed, odorous indeed must be the mead whereon they grow, and pure the wave they drink, with lilies at the brink, and sugar sweet their sap.
Great, thank you. So, the thing to notice. First of all, enter Genie, only to exit. That is, so they had a friend named Genie, and she too consumed the goblin fruits. And what happened to her?
She died.
She died. She pined away and died. And what isn't happening on her grave?
Nothing will grow.
So again, a thing to notice here is starting at line 157, then fell with the first snow, while to this day no grass will grow where she lies low. I planted daisies there a year ago that never blow. You should not loiter so. So what's happening in those six lines? What's the rhyme scheme of those six lines? Yeah, so it's just that repetition that we were seeing as in the catalog of fruits before, the cherries and berries and so on. So somehow it's the repetition of rhyme is, you could say, a good suiting of the prosody of the versification to what it's describing. But it starts feeling a little bit as though the poem is also about its own versification. Let's say maybe over the temptations of rhyme. That is, again, now, I don't want to go too fast here, but what would someone... Remember who Romney Lee is?
Yes.
Who? Okay, good.
Aurora Lee's cousin.
Yes, and what's the difference between him and Aurora?
I mean, she's a poet and he's a sort of social justice student who thinks poetry is a woman's art.
Right, and thinks poetry is not about real things. And one of the ways that you could say that poetry is not about reality, it's not about the world, is that it's about its own accidental, the accidental qualities of language. So you could say language, there's lots of things that language does, but two essential things that language do are an essential thing that language does is to describe the world. And a problem with the algorithm by which language describes the world is that it makes connections between, let's say, different sentences, not only via meaning, but also via sound. So that things can sound like each other purely accidentally. But those accidents of similarity of sound start becoming the very thing that poetry focuses on rather than on reference. So language is supposed to refer to the world, and in referring to the world, it is supposed to kind of disappear. It's a way of delivering through code a fact about the world where the code that delivers that fact disappears once the fact is communicated. Okay, does that make sense to people? So that's why you can say something in English or in French or in Latin, and you can describe the same fact in English or French or Latin or any other language. And, you know, you can say today is the first day of spring. You can say it in English. You can say it in French. You can say it in Spanish. You can say it in any Northern Hemisphere language, and it would be true. But nothing about what you're saying would sound the same in two different languages. But it wouldn't matter. They're intertranslatable. So that is the referential function of language, is that sentences are intertranslatable. Philosophically, this is sometimes described as the difference between a sentence and a proposition. A sentence is how you deliver a proposition. but the proposition is the structure is structured like the fact that it is delivering. So just to use a typical philosophical, this is an example philosophers use all the time. Snow is white and der Schnee ist weiß. They're the same proposition. And it doesn't matter that snow is white, that there's a W in snow and a W in white, and we can hear that similarity of sound. So look, isn't it so cool how snow kind of merges into whiteness? That is poetic bullshit. What matters is there, and you know it's poetic bullshit because you can say der Schnee ist weiß, and Schnee and weiß have nothing to do with each other, but it's the same fact that is being communicated in both sentences. So to know what the fact is, you just look at the proposition. So what does poetry do? It seduces you away from reality. This is what Plato says also. It seduces you away from reality by focusing on what should be simple chance elements of language. And it takes those chance elements and turns them into something that you focus on much more than the thing the language is supposed to be saying. So the more you get seduced by sound, where in poetry what sound means is not entirely but largely rhythm and rhyme and the relationship of rhythm to meter and the way rhyme interacts with rhythm and meter. All of those things become more and more prominent, and what gets lost then is a serious understanding of the facts of the world. Anyone know the line now? What I want are facts. I almost quoted it earlier in this course, but I didn't. So that's a bad guy in Dickens who is just looking for facts, the facts. That's all that matters. But poetry is not about facts. It's somehow about the experience of the language that is supposed to disappear, according to philosophers, according to technocrats, the language that is supposed to disappear once it is used instrumentally to deliver what the facts are. So here you have a poem in which the sounds keep seeming to become more and more prominent. And the prominence of the sounds in some ways seems to be determining some of what happens in the poem. Why those fruits? Because they can be made to rhyme with each other, because they repeat each other. If you were to translate this poem into French, there are lots of French berries that don't have the same endings. The word for strawberry in French is fraise. And it's not like the word for blueberries is blaise, and the word for gooseberries is craise. It's just different names for things that in English all end with the word berry. So it's something about the language that the poem is written in is also pushing the poem towards the things that it describes. So here you have even Lizzie, who is saying, then fell with the first snow, while to this day no grass will grow where she lies low. I planted daisies there a year ago that never blow. You should not loiter so. And it's not that Lizzie is seduced by sound. It's that the poem is seductive because of its sound. And if you want to say someone is seduced by it, who is that someone? Well, there's us, but who else? We're seduced by it, right? I mean, that's what makes us... Imagine translating this poem into prose. Okay, ChatGPT, what happens in Goblin Market? Well, then there's their friend Jeannie, and she has met the goblins in the moonlight and eats what they've offered, and the result is that she pines away and dies and nothing grows on her grave. And are we thinking, God, that's just so, I can't get enough of this. And if we're not thinking, I can't get enough of this, but of course we are thinking, I can't get enough of this reading the actual poem, right? What is it we can't get enough of?
How it sounds.
How it sounds. The version of the fruits. The version of what the goblin men are offering are these sounds. Who else is being seduced, or who else is seducing via these sounds? Same answer. Two questions, one answer. Okay, there's someone else you're not naming. I'll give you a hint. Her initials are CR. Yeah. It's like, you know, she writes this in one day. And what's she doing? She's writing and she's following the suggestions of rhyme. But it's not that she's just following them. It's not like, do people know who John Skelton is? So he is sometimes thought of as the first poet to write in modern English. He was a tutor to Henry VIII when Henry VIII was a child. And he wrote a kind of poem called Skeltonics, which this is vaguely related to. But Skeltonics are poems in which he just loved to rhyme. And everything that happened in a poem would, he would try to have like five or six rhyming lines in a row. And it didn't matter how long the lines were, they could be 2 to 8 syllables, let's say, as long as they rhymed. And there was this sense of things just, yeah, there's a rhyme, I can go for it. There's a rhyme, I'll go for that rhyme too. And it's just what happens or is this rhyming. So there's a thing about rhyming that is really, really attractive to a poet, especially a poet who is semi-improvising, which is what she's doing here. And by semi-improvising, I'm not saying, oh no, it's just an improvised poem. It's not, that's not the issue. It's rather that as a semi-improvised poem, it's a poem about, let's call it, the poet's experience of improvising, of how language is directing the poet's experience of improvising. So if it's language that is, let's say, causing her to rhyme as she does, then who are the goblins in that little metaphor? The goblins are a metaphor for what? Language is causing her to rhyme and to pile on rhyme on rhyme on rhyme. So who are the goblins? There are only two possible people in that scenario. There's her and there's language. Language is causing her to rhyme.
So goblins are like the individual rhymes?
Okay, but I think it's the individual rhymes or the fruits, which is how we first saw the individual rhymes, right?
Okay.
So language itself, if you were to think of it as a plural group,
goblins,
would be the goblins. So language would comprise the goblins who are saying to her, here's a rhyme. You know, and what people are saying is, Christina Rossetti, you are a Victorian woman. What are you doing up in your room writing? Why are you not cleaning the house for the men the way you should be? And why isn't she? Because there are all these rhymes that are jostling for her attention and that she can go and pile up and just amass. So it's as though she's consuming the rhymes that language is offering her. And the other thing is she's offering us those rhymes. So she can now change places with the goblins and offer us all those rhymes that we are consuming and spending a class that we could be doing Matthew Arnold in, looking at all these rhymes in Goblin Market. So Laura says, no, I had all these fruits and they were great, and I'll bring you some tomorrow. They're just so good. Sugar sweet, their sap. So it was just so wonderful. Okay, Leon, the next one is short.
Golden head by golden head, like two pigeons in one nest, folded in each other's wings, they lay down in their curtained bed, like two blossoms on one stem, like two flakes of newborn snow, like two wands of ivory, tipped with gold for awful kings. Moon and stars gaze in at them, wings send and to them lullaby. Lumbering owls forbore to fly, not a bat flapped to and fro, rounds their neck. Not a bat flapped to and fro round their rest. Cheek to cheek and breast to breast, locked together in one nest.
Great, thank you. All right, so again, you know, it's just worth doing a kind of... How many people know the book Thinking Fast and Slow? Is that a book that anyone's aware of? It was a bestseller maybe 10 years ago. Daniel Kahneman, who was the...
That's a name I know.
That's a name you know. Okay, so thinking... So Kahneman and Tversky wrote article after article after article. And Thinking Fast and Slow is his... book for the general readership of all the stuff that they discovered about human psychology. And it's a totally great book. It was a bestseller, and it was one of those bestsellers that people actually read, unlike bestsellers that people don't read. So if you really want a good, fun book to read this summer, nonfiction. I know it's hard to think of good nonfiction fun books, but this is one. Thinking Fast and Slow is one of them. And one of the things that the kinds of experiments that he reports, which are really interesting, they're different kinds of experiments, but one of them is experiments in priming, where the idea is, or do people know who Darren Brown is? Is this a, I'll just tell you a very quick Darren Brown thing. You can find this on YouTube. Maybe I'll send you a link to it if I remember. So Darren Brown is a guy who can basically get people to say exactly what he wants them to say. He's just really, really, really good at manipulating people without their knowing that he's manipulating them. So he did this amazing thing. He does lots of things like this. He would, every week he had a show where he would document doing something like this. So he did this amazing thing where he asked two advertising copywriters from Saatchi & Saatchi, which is the great ad firm, to come up in half an hour in a conference room with a possible campaign for a taxidermy shop. And he said, look, I just want to see how what you guys do. We might hire you for something, but just sit down, see what you come up with in half an hour. You don't mind if we record this. So they recorded it. and in half an hour, they came up with a pretty cool campaign for a taxidermy shop. And they explained it to Darren Brown, and he said, okay, that's really interesting. I really like this. I should show you what I came up with. And he unveils a display which has almost exactly the same thing. He's anticipated almost exactly what they've come up with. So how did he do it? He then shows how he did it. He replays what we've already seen, which is just, you know, sort of background with them in a limousine coming to the place where they're going to come up with this. And then we've already seen this, but now we see it again. And he freeze frames on various things that are going on outside the window that they don't notice. But every single thing was carefully planned so that they would subconsciously get an idea in their heads that would be on their minds, that would prime them, would be on their minds, so when they tried to come up with the ad campaign, they used all this experience that they had in the last half hour as they were driving through the streets of London. And the result is they had all this stuff on their mind. They had no idea they had this stuff on their mind, but they then repeated it in the campaign, stuff that they'd just seen, stuff that was on their mind. I'll give you another very quick example of this. True story, last week, Laura and I are driving, and I happened to notice a pickup truck ahead that had a decal of Heisenberg from Breaking Bad. That is Bryan Cranston in his Heisenberg look in Breaking Bad. Just happened to notice it. Didn't say anything about it because, you know, lots of decals, lots of bumper stickers, no big deal. And Laura says, I'm trying to remember how Better Call Saul ends. And I said, oh, you saw that decal. This is like the truck had pulled off. It wasn't in front of us anymore. And she said, no. What decal? So she did see it. That's the point. But she had no idea that she saw it, but it put in her mind trying to remember how Better Call Saul ends. So, you know, it was something on her mind, but that's what brought it to the forefront of her mind. So that's what Daniel Kahneman, one of the things he's really interested in is what's called priming, where you get people to think about certain things without their knowing that you're getting them to think about those things. And there are lots of really interesting psych experiments which show that that sort of thing can happen. So that seems to be also what's happening here. This is a really long intro to pointing out what's going on here, that there they are, like two flakes of new fallen snow, like two blossoms on one stem. By the way, anyone know where that comes from? That's, she's echoing something. We were two cherries upon one bough. So that's A Midsummer Night's Dream. And a lot of this is, she has A Midsummer Night's Dream on her mind. Like two blossoms on one stem, like two flakes of new fallen snow, like two wands of ivory tipped with gold for awful kings, moon and stars gazed in at them. That's a bizarre metaphor if you think about it. Okay, they were like two blossoms on one stem, like two flakes of new fallen snow, like two wands of ivory tipped with gold for awful kings. So, okay, I guess they have very white bodies with yellow hair, but wands of ivory tipped with gold for awful kings. I think you can imagine something else is there as well. Moon and stars gazed in at them. Wind sang to them, lullaby, lumbering owls forbore to fly. That's also Midsummer Night's Dream. Not a bat flapped to and fro round their rest, cheek to cheek and breast to breast, locked together in one nest. So why the word nest? Well, it's suggested by rest and breast because it rhymes. But it's probably also suggested by the owls that are priming her as she improvises this poem. So owls from A Midsummer Night's Dream. Birds. Okay, nest. That works.
Also, two pigeons in one
nest earlier. Say it again.
She started with two pigeons.
Yes, in
one nest.
Yeah. Or so maybe you could say the two pigeons in one nest are giving you the lumbering owls and giving you A Midsummer Night's Dream. Okay, Quinn, next one.
Early in the morning, when the first cock crowed his warning, meat like bees, as sweet and busy, Laura rose with Lizzie, fetched in honey, milked the cows, aired and set to rights the house, kneaded cakes of white as wheat, cakes for dainty mouths to eat. Next, churned butter, whipped up cream, fed their poultry, sat and sewed, talked as modest maidens should, Lizzie with an open heart, Laura in an absent dream. One content, one sick in part, one warbling for the mere bright day's delight, one longing for the night.
Okay, so who's longing for the night?
Laura.
Yeah. So they're doing their little chores, but Laura's mind is elsewhere in the absent dream, longing for the night. And again, longing for the night is always going to be read as an erotic, having an erotic component to it. Irina, can you do the next stanza?
At length, slow evening came. They went with pitchers to the reedy brook. Lizzie most placid in her look, Laura most like a leaping flame. They drew the gurgling water from the sea. Lizzie plucked purple and rich golden clay. Then turning homeward said, the sunset flushes, those furthest lofty crags. Come, Laura, not another maiden leg, no willful squirrel wags. The beasts and birds are fast asleep, but Laura loitered still among the rushes and said the bank was steep.
Okay, so no willful squirrel wags. So you can see that that's kind of a forced rhyme. But, you know, it rhymes. That's what's good. Red.
And said the hour was early still.
So it's Laura who says that. Okay.
The dew not fawn, the wind not chill. Listening ever, but not catching the customary cry, come by, come by. With its iterated jingle of sugar-baited words, not for all her watching, once discerning even one goblin, racing, whisking, tumbling, hobbling, let alone the herds that used to tramp along the glen, in groups or single, of brisk fruit merchant men. Till Lizzie urged, oh Laura, come, I hear the fruit call, but I dare not look, you should not loiter longer at this brook. Come with me home, the stars rise, the moon bends her arc, each glowworm winks her spark. Let us get home before the night grows dark, for clouds may gather, though this is summer weather. Put out the lights and drag us through. Then if we lost our way, what should we do?
Great, thank you. So notice that she gets completely explicit here about the iterated jingle of sugar-baited words. Another way of describing rhyme, or the rhymes in this poem, the iterated jingle of sugar-baited words. But she doesn't hear the customary cry, come by, come by. Who does hear it?
Lizzie.
Yeah, so Lizzie can hear it, but Laura can't. So that is the first hint to Laura that something really is wrong. Sam.
Laura turned cold as stone to find her sister heard that cry alone, that goblin cry. Come by her fruits, come by. Must she then buy no more such dainty fruit? Must she no more such succotious
succus.
Pasture.
So succus means full of sap or full of juice.
Gone deaf and blind, her tree of life drooped from the root. She said not one word in her heart sore ache, but peering through the dimness, not discerning, trudged home, her pitcher dripping all the way. So she crept to bed and lay silent till Lizzie slept, then sat up in a passionate yearning and gnashed her teeth for balked desire and wept as if her heart would break.
Great, thank you. So succus fruits full, again, of juice, no more for her. Her tree of life drooped from the root. So this doesn't need to be underlined for you, right? I mean, all the sexual descriptions here. And she sits up in a passionate yearning and gnashed her teeth for balked desire and wept as if her heart would break. So that's a description of erotic blockage, of erotic... the end of something erotic, the impossibility of the erotic fantasy that she had. Sophia?
Day after day, night after night, Laura kept watch in vain, in the sullen silence of exceeding pain. She never caught again the goblin cry, come by, come by. She never spied the goblin men hawking their fruits along the glen, but when the moon waxed bright, her hair grew thin and gray. She dwindled as the fair full moon doth turn to swift decay and burn her fire away.
Yeah, so what happens to her? It seems to happen very fast, but it happens.
She gets older.
She gets old. Yeah. There it is. She never spied the goblin men. So this is a description of early sexual experience, and all its novelty and all its wonder has disappeared. And that experience that she had when young, you know, if you were reading this poem entirely allegorically, if you were reading it the way William Blake would have meant it, do people know his poem, The Angel? I don't know if I can recite it, but it's, I dreamt a dream. What can it, it's a, one of the songs of experience. I dreamt a dream, what can it mean? And that I was a maiden queen guarded by an angel mild. Witless woe was ne'er beguiled. And I wept both night and day, and he wiped my tears away. And I wept both day and night, and hid from him my heart's delight. She may actually have this poem in mind. Blake was only starting to become known at the time, but her brother was one of the people who was interested in Blake. So, I dreamt a dream that I was a maiden queen guarded by an angel mild, and I wept both night and day, and he wiped my tears away. And so then she says, and I wept both day and night and hid from him my heart's delight. She likes the fact that he's kissing her tears away. And then the last stanza. Soon my angel came again. I was armed. He came in vain. Actually, I skipped a stanza. Then the stars threw down their spears and watered heaven with their tears. And then soon my angel came again. I was armed. He came in vain. For the time of youth had fled and gray hairs were on my head. So it's a poem about the wonder of erotic experience when it's new to you. Like, wow! You can have this experience with another person. And then what happens when it becomes something that doesn't come as a surprise, but comes as something that you're aiming at? Let me go to Tinder. Let's see what happens. So the idea of naive, passionate love becomes routinized. So I wept both day and night and hid from him my heart's delight. So that, and then the result of that is, once he becomes sexually experienced, is what this poem, and also what Goblin Market seems to say, that's the first sign of old age, is becoming not your first sexual experience, but becoming good at it, becoming experienced at it, knowing how to go about it. First sign of old age. And then gray hairs are on your head. So this is what happens to Laura. Her hair grew thin and gray. Okay, I'll do the next stanza since we should all do it. One day, remembering her kernel stone. So do you remember her kernel stone? One day, remembering her kernel stone, she set it by a wall that faced the south, dewed it with tears, hoped for a root, watched for a waxing shoot. Okay, so don't have to go into the symbolism there, right? But there came none. It never saw the sun. It never felt the trickling moisture run. While with sunk eyes and faded mouth, she dreamed of melons as a traveler sees false waves in desert drought with shade of leaf-crowned trees and burns the thirstier in the sandful breeze. So, yeah, there's nothing there. She's hoping for sexual arousal, let's say, both male and female, but it's not happening. So she just stops even taking care of the house.
She no more swept the house, tended the fowls or cows, fetched honey, kneaded cakes of wheat, brought water from the brook, but sat down listless in the chimney nook and would not eat.
So remember earlier, before she goes out again, she and Lizzie have been doing that, but no more. Okay, Liam?
Okay. tender Lizzie could not bear to watch her sister's cankerous care, yet not to share. She night and morning caught the goblin's cry, "Come by our orchard fruits, come by, come by." Beside the brook along the glen, she heard the tramp of goblin men. The voice and stir poor Laura could not hear. Longed to buy fruit to comfort her, but fear to pay to bear. She thought of Jeannie in her grave, who should have been a bride, but who for joys brides hope to have, fell sick and died in her gay prime. In earliest winter time was the first glazing rime, was the first snowfall of crisp winter time.
Great, thank you. So again, lest you don't get it, Rossetti goes even further. That why did Jeannie fall sick and die? She ate the fruit, and why did she eat the fruit? What did she aim at in eating the fruit?
A sexual pleasure.
Yeah, she aimed at the joys brides hope to have. So the joys brides hope to have is the joy of sexuality. But she ate the fruit trying to get those joys, and the result is that she fell sick and died in her gay prime in earliest winter time. Okay, Quinn.
To Laura, dwindling seemed knocking at death's door. Then Lizzie weighed no more, better and worse, but put a silver penny in her purse, kissed Laura across the heath with clumps of furs. At twilight, pelted by the brook, and for the first time in her life, began to listen to Laura.
Okay, so what does Lizzie decide to do?
Go buy some fruit.
Because Laura can't, because she doesn't know where the goblin men are. They no longer appear to her. Okay, Irina.
Laughed at every goblin when they spied her peeping. Came towards her hobbling, flying, running, leaping, puffing and blowing, chuckling, clapping, crowing, clucking and gobbling, mopping and mowing, full of air and graces, pulling wry faces, veneer grimaces, cat-like and rat-like, raffle and wombat-like, snail-faced in a hurry, parrot-voiced and whistler, helter-skelter, hurry-scurry, chattering like magpies, fluttering like pigeons, gliding like fishes, hugged her and kissed her, squeezed and caressed her, stretched up their dishes, panniers and plates, look at our apples, russet and dun, bob at our cherries, bite at our peaches, citrons and dates, grapes for the asking, pears red with basking, out in the sun, plums on their twigs, pluck them and suck them, pomegranates, figs.
Okay, so lots of sexual offering here to Lizzie. The goblins are so happy, there she is. And we're back to the iterative language, the iterative jingle at the beginning of the poem. And now Lizzie is experiencing that. Okay, Red.
Good folk, said Lizzie, mindful of Jeannie, give me much and many. Held out her apron, tossed them her penny. Nay, take a seat with us, honor and eat with us, they answered, grinning. Our feast is but beginning. Night yet is early, warm and dew pearly.
So remember what we said about pearls of dew. Go on.
Wakeful and starry, such fruits as these no man can carry. Half their bloom would fly, half their dew would dry, half their flavor would pass by. Sit down and feast with us, be welcome guest with us. Cheer you and rest with us. Thank you, said Lizzie, but one waits at home alone for me. So without further parleying, if you will not sell me any of the fruits, though much and many, give me back my silver penny I tossed you for a fee. They began to scratch their pates, no longer wagging, purring, but visibly demurring, grunting and snarling. One called her proud, cross-grained, uncivil. Their tones waxed loud, their looks were evil. Lashing their tails, they trod, hustled her, elbowed and jostled her, clawed with their nails, barking, mewing, hissing, mocking, tore her gown and soiled her stocking, twitched her hair out by the roots, stamped upon her tender feet, held her hands and squeezed their fruits against her mouth to make her eat.
Great, thank you. So, close to rape. It's, again, remember this is psychology. And if you treat it as psychologically, what she's doing is resisting the blandishments. You know, let's say the goblins are hormones. would be one way of understanding them. She's resisting those blandishments, but they are really pushing her and, you know, taking the poem literally. This is close to trying to force her to have sex, but she's refusing. Okay, Sam?
Why do Goldie Lily stood like a fly in the flood?
Wait, like a lily.
Oh, yes. Like a lily in a flood. Like a rock of blue-veined stone lashed by tides obstreplessly. Like a beacon left alone in a hoary, roaring sea. Sending up a golden fire. Like a fruit-crowned orange tree. White with blossoms, honey-sweet, sort of best. Beset by wasp and bee, like a royal virgin town, toppled with gilded dome and spire, close beleaguered by a fleet, mad to tug her standard down.
So she's like a virgin town, a royal virgin town, an interesting metaphor. And they are trying to invade this town. So again, it's obvious what the metaphor is. Sophia?
When they lead a horse to water, plenty cannot make him drink. So the goblins cuffed and caught her, coaxed and fought her, bullied and besought her, scratched her, pinched her black as ink, kicked and knocked her, mauled and mocked her. Lizzie uttered not a word, but not open from lip, lest they should cram a mouthful in, but laughed in heart to feel the drip of juice that syruped all her face, and lodged in dimples of her chin, and streaked her neck with quick curve. At last the evil people, worn out by her resistance, flung back the penny, kicked their fruit along whichever road they took, not leaving root or stone or shoot. Some writhed into the ground, some dived into the brook with ring and ripple, some scudded on the gale without a sound, and some vanished into the distance.
Okay, so this may be the second dirtiest stanza we're going to read this semester. And maybe the second dirtiest thing you will read in any English class at your time at Brandeis. So it's as dirty as it seems. But she doesn't open her mouth. So in a smart ache tingle, Lizzie went her way. Knew not was it night or day. Sprang up the bank, tore through the furs, threaded copse and dingle, and heard her penny jingle bouncing in her purse. So there again is the idea of jingling or rhyming. Its bounce was music to her ear. She ran and ran as if she feared some goblin man dogged her with gibe or curse or something worse. But not one goblin scurried after, nor was she pricked by fear. And as I said before, that word has the connotations then that it has now. It did in Shakespeare, too. It did in Chaucer, too. Then pricketham natura near courages. The kind heart made her windy paste that urged her home quite out of breath with haste and inward laughter. So she's delighted. Julia.
She cried, Laura, up the garden. Did you miss me? Come and kiss me. Never mind my bruises. Hug me, kiss me, suck my juices. Squeezed from goblin fruits for you. Goblin pulp and goblin dew. Eat me, drink me, love me. Laura, make much of me. For your sake, I have braved the glen and had to do with goblin merchantmen.
Okay, so, we don't have to dwell on that, right? It's obvious. Leon?
Okay. Laura started from her chair, flung her arms up in the air, clutched her hair. Lizzie, Lizzie, have you tasted for my sake the fruit forbidden? Must your light like mine be hidden, your young life like mine be wasted? Undone in my done doing, and ruined in my ruin, thirsty, cankered, goblin-ridden. She clung about her sister, kissed and kissed and kissed her. Tears once again refreshed her shrunken eyes, dropping like rain after a long, sultry drought. Shaking with anguish, fear, and pain, she kissed and kissed her with a hungry mouth.
So what is she hungry for?
There's still the fruit, I feel.
Yeah, so she's kissing her sister passionately. This is not simply sisterly kissing, with hungry mouth because of the juices that are all over her sister. Okay, Quinn.
Her lips began to scorch. That juice was wormwood to her tongue. She loathed with these, writhing as one possessed. She leaped and sung,
rent all of her robe and wrung her hands in lamentable case, and beat her breast, her locks streamed like the torch, borne by a razor at full speed, or like the mane of horses in their flight, or like an eagle when she stems the light straight toward the sun, or like a caged thing free, or like a flying fly when on the ground.
Great, thank you. So all these juices, they no longer taste good. This passionate relationship she's having with her sister, it's not doing it for her sexually. Irina.
Swift fire spread through her veins, knocked at her heart, met the fire smoldering there and overbore its lesser flame. She gorged on bitterness without a name. Ah, fool to choose such part of soul-consuming care. Sense failed in the mortal strike, like the watchtower of a town, which an earthquake shatters down, like a lightning-stricken mast, like a wind-uprooted tree, spun about, like a foam-topped waterspout. Cast down headlong in the sea, she fell at last. Pleasure past and anguish past. Is it death or is it life?
Okay, let's do one more stanza, and we'll have to finish it Wednesday. No, can we do it? We can. Let's do it quick. Red.
Life out of death. That night long, Lizzie walked by her, counted her pulses black and stirred. Fell for her breath, held water to her lips, and cooled her face with tears and fanning leaves. But when the first birds chirped about their eaves, and early reapers plodded to the place of golden sheaves, and dew-wet grass bowed in the morning winds so brisk to pass, and new buds with new day opened of cup like lilies on the stream, Laura awoke as from a dream, laughed in the innocent old way, hugged Lizzie but not twice or thrice. Her gleaming locks showed not one thread of gray. Her breath was sweet as May, and light danced in her eyes.
So this passionate adolescent, same sex, other sex, what Freud calls polymorphous sexuality, all of that she's now gotten through. And she laughs in the innocent old way. Light dances in her eyes. She has, let's say, achieved a mature relationship to sexual desperateness. Sam, why didn't you finish it?
Days, weeks, months, years afterwards, when both were wives with children of their own, their mother hearts beset with fears, their lives bound up in tender lies. Laura would call the little ones and tell them of her early crime, those pleasant days long gone with not returning time. Would talk about the haunted plant, the wicked, quaint fruit merchant men, the fruits like honey to the throat, but poison in the blood. Men sell not such in any town. Would tell them how that her sister stood in deadly peril to do her good and win the fiery antidote. Then joining hands to little men, would bid them cling together, for there is no friend like a sister in calm or stormy weather to cheer one on the tedious way, to fetch one if one goes astray, to lift one if one trotters down, to strengthen walls one stands.
Great, thank you. So the very quick thing to say about this is that what is amazing and psychologically true about this is it's not that her children go through the same thing. They become mothers. They have little ones of their own. She tells the story of the goblins. But you would think that, yeah, of course, the little ones are going to do the same thing. Next generation, sexual awakening, goblins try to seduce them and so on. But not in this poem. And the focus on one's own experience, in a way, that's what's psychologically most accurate about this, is the way this is about her life, her experience, her relation with her sisters, and so on, and then her relation with her children. But it's not like, yes, every generation goes through this. This is a great description of her and their lives, rather than simply a description of the cycle of human life. It's not the cycle of life. And if it is the cycle of life, a way to put this is that the cycle of life includes the fact that you don't look at other people of other generations and think, oh yes, they're going through the same cycle that I went through. Because that's not something we usually do. You don't look at your parents' generation and think, Oh, yes, when they were adolescents, they were just like me when I was an adolescent. You just don't do that. It's you are at the center of your life, and you don't think of them as having similar centers. And then when they become parents, they don't think of their children as having similar centers. And it's not, oh, how wrong they are. That's what Christina Rossetti is saying. She's describing human experience. And I think she does it amazingly well, and does it amazingly well also in describing the experience of poetry, of just what's seductive about language. Okay, we'll stop there. We will do the Rubaiyat, which is shorter, but we'll do the whole thing, the whole first edition, on Wednesday.